Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. On this month's show, a new anthology of poems from New Mexicans highlights themes of community, culture, history, and landscape. We'll talk with Associate Professor Levi Romero and his co-editor, poet Michelle Otero, about the collection. And we'll revisit an interview I did last year with filmmaker-turned-author Ramona Emerson about her debut novel, Shudder. Levi Romero was New Mexico's first poet laureate. He's also a professor of Chicana and Chicano studies at the University of New Mexico. His most recent book is the co-edited anthology Querencia, Reflections on the New Mexico Homeland. His two collections of poetry are A Poetry of Remembrance, New and Rejected Works, and In the Gathering of Silence. Michelle Otero is a former poet laureate of Albuquerque. She's the author of Malinche's Daughter, an essay collection based on her work with women survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault in Oaxaca, Mexico, as a Fulbright Fellow, and Bosque, Poems, from University of New Mexico Press, a collection written during her poet laureate tenure. Levi and Michelle, welcome to University Showcase.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Levi, why did you want to create this anthology, and how did you decide to bring in Michelle as your co-editor?
Yeah, the anthology was part of my duties as New Mexico Poet Laureate, so that was already written into it. And then I just wanted to work with somebody that was familiar with the poetry landscape across New Mexico, and none other better than Michelle. There were a few other names that came up, but we chose her to work with, and it's been great.
And Michelle, what was your response when he reached out to ask you?
I think first it was giddiness, followed by, really, me? And then, absolutely, yes. I mean, what an honor to be able to put this together and to be able to do it with Levi during his tenure as Poet Laureate.
When you say it was part of that, is that like a goal you came up with as Poet Laureate or
it
something?
It was the Poet Laureate program that had established all the different goals for the Poet Laureate, inaugural Poet Laureate at that time, myself. And so there were other things in association with that. But it happened during the pandemic. My tenure happened during the pandemic. So a lot of the things that they had written out for me just went out the window at that point. Like visiting community libraries and community centers and going across the state and things like that.
Michelle, you had a similar experience, didn't you?
Yeah.
As Albuquerque Poet Laureate?
So we almost tag team, even though they were different. You know, I was Albuquerque Poet Laureate. Levi was New Mexico Poet Laureate. But my laureateship, it was coming to an end when everything shut down. So I got a good, 16 months, I think, of being able to do things in person. And then the last few months, it was all via Zoom.
How did the pandemic influence the creation of this, the process of it?
Well, this part of it happened after the pandemic, didn't it? When we went into working on the anthology, I don't think we were in the pandemic any longer because we were meeting in person and going over what we wanted to do with the anthology.
Yeah. I was thinking thematically.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think, so we weren't quite on lockdown, which helped. We were able to, and I think maybe poems started coming in while we were still locked down. It's hard. Pandemic years are like, each year is about 8 years.
So. I know, isn't that weird?
It was kind of a weird thing. I think you could definitely feel it in some of the poems. So I think some of the poems definitely have the feel of people paying really close attention, of not being able to leave home, of looking really closely at things, which I think poetry does anyway. A few folks probably addressed it directly, but we had come up with the themes even before everything shut down. So I think there's a way that the pandemic kind of hangs, or maybe not hangs over it, maybe it colors a few of the poems, and it's still very much New Mexico.
Talk about the themes.
We had 11 themes that we came up with. There were actually a few more themes, but we decided on these 11, community, culture, family, history, identity, landscape, nature, people, querencia, spirituality, and water, and then sub-themes under all those in whatever way the poets chose to respond to any one of those themes.
Talk about querencia.
Querencia is the northern New Mexico word that we have for the place where you're born and raised, but it's also the place where you feel at home, where you feel you belong, where you feel safe, where you feel nurtured. And so querencia is broader than the place where you're born and raised, because oftentimes I have found out in teaching my class on cadencia that not everybody has the same sense of cadencia that I did growing up. Some people didn't have cadencia at home. They didn't have family. They didn't have community. And so they find that sense of nurturing and belonging somewhere else.
And you say in your preface, in these pages, you will find published poets alongside your next-door neighbors, census workers, poets laureate, teachers, senators, high school students, professors, healthcare workers, doctors, and spoken word artists, all revealing something of themselves that can only be felt through poetry. How did you select the poems in here? That's quite a wide array of people.
So it was anonymous. We put out a call for submissions and then invited folks to submit up to 3 poems. I think we ended up reading more than 700 poems, and we didn't know who had written them, which I think is better. Because, you know, anytime there's a project like this, there's an opportunity to include a lot of people, but there's also an opportunity to leave out some folks. And so we really wanted it to be about how a particular poet spoke to a theme or expressed something about the state and their relationship with it, rather than like, oh, we really like this person and we'd love to publish them. Yeah.
What surprised you by some of the poems you got?
I think it really wasn't so much a surprise. What was really great to see about the response was how much people love New Mexico and how they're responding through it through poetry.
Certainly a love for New Mexico. There's also a lot of difficult things about New Mexico in it. So it's quite a canvas.
Yeah, I think that's also love, right? You think about your closest relationships or a relationship with a particular place. And I think part of loving someone or some place also means that you're able to see it clearly. And so we didn't want this to be as though we were, you know, like at a eulogy when somebody's eulogizing someone and they only say the great things, right? We really wanted it to be like, we love this place enough to be able to look at it honestly and to do that with compassion and understanding of why that is and a desire for us to be able to kind of live into the story of who we can be.
Truthful and honest and not really presenting kind of like a postcard version of New Mexico, but what it really is like to live here and to be from here, to have it cadencia, the Nuevo Mexicano cadencia in your heart.
Mm-hmm. Were you surprised after you selected the poems you wanted and then you saw who wrote them in their biographies?
That was fun. I think that was like being able to go. It's a little bit like opening presents where you're, you know, I think this person, you know, or maybe having an idea of like, oh, I wonder if this person submitted or I wonder. Of course, we were happy to see the names of folks we knew. But I was also, and I think Levi, too, we were really thrilled to be able to see so many names of people we had never heard of. And that feels really gratifying to maybe give someone their first publication or to have a lot of work in here that really is about the work and not just about folks in our immediate circle.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that was one of the great, wonderful, surprising things about it, too, is when we're reading through the bios and you see these bios from people who you'd never heard of before. Like it said in the introduction there, you know, just your next door neighbor. Just somebody that you're not familiar with, that you had never heard of, had never heard in a poetry open mic or any place like that, that, you know, was compelled to contribute, to submit something. And that was one of the great rewards about it.
Neither of you have a poem in it.
No.
We chose not to, have our own work.
Okay. What do you hope people will take away from these poems or take with them or keep with them?
The diversity of the voices and the experiences of Nuevo Mexico, you know, and I think that it is really representative of New Mexico. I was talking to Ana Gallegos, the publisher from Museum of New Mexico Press, about now we've been discussing like where to market the book. And I was saying that just recently as I was flying in back to Albuquerque, as I was walking through the airport, and I was looking at the gift stores there, the gift shops. I was thinking to myself, those would be great places to have this book, because as people are leaving New Mexico, they can take a piece of them with it, and the real New Mexico, too, as well.
Mm. What about you, Michelle?
I hope that people find, you know, all of the things that Levi spoke about, but also and also that they discover poetry isn't scary. right? I think a lot of folks have a belief about poetry. Maybe we feel about poetry the way we do about math. If we weren't good at math, where it's like some mystery language,
yeah,
or you have to have
sure,
a degree.
I can see that.
Yeah. And I think there are some poems here that maybe ask for a little more attention or maybe require a little more of our time. And I think that's a beautiful thing. And there are also some poems that are really accessible, that really are like, you know, like your Nana just saying, like, come sit down at the table. Let's just talk. And all of them are worth folks' time. So I hope they engage with it.
Yeah, absolutely. What Michelle is saying, and, you know, the collection is about bringing all these different voices, all these different poets at different levels together, and where no one poem is greater than another. They're all beautiful together.
What kinds of events have you planned, or has the Museum of New Mexico planned around the book?
I mean, we've been fortunate in that a lot of folks are stepping forward to plan events. So we had one in Santa Fe a couple of weeks ago at Collected Works Bookstore. They planned that. There's one coming up on Sunday, the 29th of October from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Albuquerque Museum. And we've invited about 20 readers. I think that's the challenge, that, you know, you have so many poets, there's no way we can do a reading with all 200. So we've kind of randomly selected folks. But Mary Oishi, the former poet laureate, will be one of the readers. Rebecca Aronson, other folks, I think all of our poets laureate from Albuquerque have been invited. And then we're working with the Museum of New Mexico Press. They're looking at events that we can do around the state, some of which Levi and I will attend, and then others will just support from afar because it's a big state.
So, the way the museum, the press is looking at it is just geographically.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to see, are there any poems or any lines or anything you'd like to read or you'd like to highlight? I know that puts a lot of pressure because of, you know, numerous poets in here.
I know.
Well, David Steinberg asked me the same question for my interview with him. And I'll tell you, my answer to him was that I couldn't do that because to pick one is to leave another one out.
Okay.
And so, I mean, you can just flip to any page and find a poem there or a line and not even say whose name it is from. And it's just going to be as poetic as the next page that you turn to.
I hear what you're saying. It's hard to choose one, but, you know, you guys are just have such great voices. I thought I'd try and trick you into it.
Nice try.
It is a beautiful volume, and that was also one of the great surprises for me, even considering how familiar Michelle and I were with the poetry. When the book came in the mail and I picked it up, whoa, I was just like blown away by the, just it's a serious volume, and it feels like a serious volume of poetry, and it's beautiful, well done. Thank you so much to the Museum of New Mexico Press for the editorial work and just helping to really put it together. Also, the folks over at the State Library that were working with us at the time, too, Eli and Tim, who were over there, very instrumental in, you know, just getting the whole book off the ground to begin with. So our thanks to them.
I saw you looking through the book. You were going to do something.
There was just one little line.
Okay.
It's from Patricia Perea's poem, The Glorious Mysteries. It's a long poem. And I think I'll just say another plug. We have some poems that are very short, and then others, we didn't have line restrictions. So you're able to get like a real variety in terms of length, too, and voice. But from section 3, without rain, life is brittle and sharp.
Nice. That's very lovely.
I love a lot of lines, but
yes,
that's speaking to me today.
Is there anything else you would like to add that I didn't ask about?
We invite folks to come out on the 29th from 1 to 3 at the Albuquerque Museum. There's a whole array of poets, Albuquerque poets, 20 or so poets that are going to be there. And so we invite the public to come out and support them.
Is there a word for a gathering of poets? It's like a dazzle of poets.
Which word?
A herd of poets.
A flock, a That's gaggle, right. I don't know.
All right. Well, Levi Romero and Michelle Otero, thanks. Thanks for coming and talking with me.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you.
That was UNM Professor Levi Romero and Michelle Otero, who co-edited New Mexico Poetry Anthology 2023, published by Museum of New Mexico Press. There will be an event with readings by some of the poets on October 29th at the Albuquerque Museum. Find out more at kunm.org. Now we'll hear part of an interview I did last year with Ramona Emerson. She's a Diné writer and filmmaker originally from Tohatchi, New Mexico. She is also a University of New Mexico alum with a degree in media arts. She's made 7 films and runs the production company Real Indian Pictures with her husband, Kelly Byers. But she published her first novel last year called Shutter. It follows Rita, a Diné woman who works as a forensic photographer capturing gruesome crime scenes for the Albuquerque Police Department and who also struggles with the ghosts from those crimes who want justice. It was long listed for the National Book Award and is now out in paperback. How much of you is in Rita, who's the protagonist in Shutter, and how much did you draw from other people in your own imagination?
I'd say it's probably a 50-50 mix of me and my imagination. Mm-hmm. I don't see ghosts. I don't speak with ghosts.
That sounds like a good thing based on what I've read so far.
And I'm really glad because, at least as far as Rita experiences it. I did work a lot of years doing forensics, and I had a lot of issues with police officers, with attorneys, you know, all the life struggles you go through when you do that kind of work. And that's in there. Mm-hmm. And but a lot of the stuff that goes on with her and her grandmother and growing up on the reservation, a lot of that's very personal stories. I was very close to my grandmother. I wanted to make sure she was a really central part of the book because she's in just about almost everything I've written, my grandma. And so I knew that she had to be a part of it. And so a lot of the Rita stuff details have been changed.
Her relatives in the book struggle with her choice of profession because of taboos and Diné culture around death. Did you encounter that?
I did. I think I freaked myself out most of the time because I would see something, and when you grow up and people are telling you that this is going to happen and you're going to die if you talk about death, it's kind of this taboo thing, like, don't talk about it, otherwise you're asking for it. So I always had this fear growing up. And when I realized what kind of work we did over there, because I really didn't understand what forensics meant, and my first few assignments were really boring, so traffic patterns and things like really boring stuff, so I didn't realize it. But when I first got a first death scene that I processed, it freaked me out and it gave me nightmares, and I had to tell my grandma that I was kind of having nightmares, and she asked me why, and I had to tell her what I was doing, and she was not pleased, but she knew I needed the job. My boss would actually lend me video equipment on the weekends because I wanted to work on my documentaries, and that's why I stayed there so long. And he let me use the studio to edit when I needed to, and he was very supportive of my work outside of forensics. But yeah, I did take it home with me, and you can't help it, especially when you work and you're doing a case with a baby in it or a little kid or even an older person. I did a lot of cases out on Navajo Res or on the Pueblos, and you think about those people forever. I never stopped thinking about those people I had cases with even 15 years ago. I wonder how they're doing or how their kids are doing, because that's the work we do. It's kind of hard to do that work sometimes. But after a while, it becomes like a quest. Like, you do that work because you know that your work is important, and if you don't do the work, maybe these guys won't win their case.
Among the other things Rita has to struggle with is this overwhelmingly male Anglo police force. How does that inform who she is? Why did you want to explore that?
It's a real reality for women who work in that field. When you work as a videographer, as a photographer, any woman who works in that field will tell you that you always get the stare down when you come in because they don't expect a woman to be there. You show up and they're saying, well, he's going to be there and blah, blah, blah. He's going to show up. And then they come into the room and they're like, oh, you're the videographer. Well, hold on. You know, like, you're not capable of doing that work. When I was coming out of film school here and trying to get in, the explanation to me was that, well, you need to get into the union if you want to get into any kind of production jobs. But you need to get experience to get into the union. How, if you can't get a job without being in the union, how are you supposed to get experience to get into the union? And I realized right then I was not going to ever work below the line because I couldn't take the attitudes that people gave me trying to enter that part of the industry. As a woman, I didn't want to be looked down upon. I didn't want to be scolded. I didn't want to be, you know, and that's kind of how you get treated as a woman in the film industry on set. When you're working for the police, when you're working for lawyers, they can be very rude to you and very nasty. And I wanted people to realize that that's what Rita deals with on a daily basis. It's colonialism stripped away in its most purest and contemporary form, but mm-hmm. it still is what it is. So you come as a woman, if you come as a brown woman, it's even different, even more of an issue. I think after doing it for, 10 years, those lawyers and those police started to see me all the time, and they realized I wasn't going to go anywhere, and I did good work, and I eventually had their respect. But it took a long time for them to realize that, hey, she does good work, maybe she's not stupid.
Did you know you had a novel in you?
No. I had no idea, because this was like my first rodeo, really. I mean, aside from a few short stories, I had nothing out there. Nobody knew me as a writer. So it was very strange. It was very strange. And I never in my wildest imagination would have told you that I would have wrote a novel or that I would want to do it. Mm-hmm. Because, quite frankly, I don't really like it. So, but it's happening.
But is this, I understand this is going to be a trilogy?
It is.
So you got two more?
Two more.
Are you writing them now?
I am. I'm writing the second one right now. And I haven't figured out what to write about the third. But I figure in the middle of the second one, it'll come to me. Mm-hmm. Because I kind of understood what I was going to write the second book about halfway into the first book. It's already got a title. It's called Exposure.
You're going to do a screenplay? As well?
I don't know.
Mm, okay.
I don't know. I feel kind of burnt out mm-hmm. on the whole film industry.
Really?
And so people are asking me right away, like, oh, are you going to turn this into a film? And I'm kind of like, I don't know. I don't know if I want to. After 25 years of doing it and not seemingly getting anywhere, I don't know. I'm distancing myself from that whole part of my life. I have documentaries to finish. I have 3 and a docuseries I'm working on. And I'm really concentrating on those because I'm seriously thinking about those being my last things that I do in the film industry and getting out.
What do you think writing has allowed you to do that perhaps you couldn't do with film?
One of the cool things about writing is that you don't have to worry about your budget or what actor you're going to get to play who and so-and-so and how you'd shut down a freeway in Albuquerque for 12 hours while you filmed a scene. I mean, if I was writing this as a screenplay, that's all I'd be thinking about. Like, how could I afford this? But when I write it as fiction, I can do whatever I want. And it doesn't matter how much it's going to cost if they turn it into a movie or whatever. For me, what is important is that the story is going well, that I create a good representation of myself and my community, because I wrote it for them. I wrote it for Tohatchi. I wrote it for Navajos because I wanted them to have a story that came from us, that came from our space. And for so many years, we haven't had that. We've had people who don't come from our place telling stories about us and kind of turning us into mystical creatures and weirdness. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just felt like this was my time to do something for the Navajo people, give them their stories back and give them their voice. I want them to recognize their own experiences in my words and to find that connection. So for me, that's what's so cool about the written word is that you could do that. There's something about having people from your community read your book and be excited to know what's out in the world that is just so much more satisfying to me than it getting into a film festival or some gatekeeper finally letting me in the gate.
What's been the reaction in your community to the book? People like it?
Actually, Dr. Danette Dale, who's mm-hmm. here at UNM.
Yeah, I've interviewed her on the show, actually.
Oh, awesome. She's one of my dearest mentors. And when this book came out, I asked her to review it for the Navajo Times. She's also from Tohatchi. We're from the same community. And so I was so scared to give it to Dr. D. I was like, oh, I hope she doesn't hate it, or call me and say, I can't believe you wrote this book. But she encouraged me to go and take the book to a Gallup flea market and to do a signing out at Ellis Tanner Trading Post, mm-hmm. both of which I was really scared about because I didn't know how people would react to what I was writing. But when we went there, Dr. D, of course, was super awesome and was telling everybody to come get over here and buy this book. So, Danae woman wrote it. She's from Tohatchi. And people were like, oh, okay. They came walking over and they were interested and they bought the books, and it was just something very special about that day. And a lot of people came down to the trading post after that mm-hmm. and, bought books, and we did a little signing there. But it was so good to see them happy to meet me and not freaked out, because they could read the book. They knew what, they could read the sleeve. They knew what it was about. Nobody got freaked out. I didn't get lectured. You know, nobody chased after me with a pitchfork. It was actually really like one of the best experiences I've ever had with my work, because it's just, and it's, I think it's just that idea of your own people embracing you and telling you it's okay that you wrote this. And we got to admit, we kind of like this stuff because, you know, we like horror movies. We like scary movies too. And, you know, it's just good to see somebody from our community doing it. Hmm. So there were a lot of people actually from Tohatchi that came to the flea market and bought the book.
Well, it's, yeah, I was going to ask you, because your first medium has always been film up until now. But how did you decide that you wanted to be a storyteller and you wanted to follow that path?
My mom and my grandma and I always had a real big passion for watching movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, I hear stories about how I went to Godfather Part II and Exorcist when I was an infant. I don't remember that, but I don't. And I didn't cry or fuss. And they were like, oh, you know, she likes being in the movie theater. And my grandma took me to the movies all the time. I forced her to take me to see The Shining when I was like 7.
So you do like horror.
Oh, yeah. I love horror. And my mom really loves horror, too. We watched some of the goriest movies ever. I watched Texas Chainsaw Massacre with my mom. Like, we've seen it all. My grandma is a little more on the action side. She kind of likes Clint Eastwood and, you know, Charles Bronson. Also, we watched a lot of bad John Wayne movies because she likes to watch, you know, old school stuff like, you know, the Sons of Katie Elder or The Cowboys or, you know, The Searcher is one of the worst movies ever. But she, but, you know, but she like, and we'd like to watch it and make fun of, you know, mm-hmm. Richard Widmark and mm-hmm. that kind of thing. So it was just, I think, that whole idea of telling stories and watching films and reading books and, you know, even telling stories to each other, you know, around the table. We always, I told you that one story about, you know, it was just something that always happened. And my grandma always had the greatest stories that she would tell us about some of the most outlandish stuff. We were like, no way that could have happened. My grandma was like, I told you. And then my grandma taught me to read and writing little stories when I was in like second and third grade was something I liked to do, they tell me. The VCR was like the best invention ever for the res. every film in that damn video store rental place trailer down at the end of the res, we'd seen every film in there 100 times.
Well, Ramona Emerson, thank you so much for talking with me. It's been
great. Absolutely. Thanks for having me in, and
good luck on finishing the next book and all those films.
Thank you so much. I need it.
That was filmmaker and author Ramona Emerson. I interviewed her last year about her novel Shutter, which is now out in paperback. You can find all our episodes of University Showcase at KUNM.org. Thanks to Associate Professor David Bashwinner for our theme music. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thank you for listening to University Showcase here on KUNM.